Hey, first things first, Mr. Chairman, members of the council, thank you very much for this opportunity to actually be able to brief you on this management plan. Some of you who are sitting around the table were involved in the working groups or on the advisory council. Some of the folks in the back were also either former council members who had been involved in the process, and we recognize that help and appreciate it. The draft management plan, it's been a long time in preparation. You may remember, actually, in this very place, the Holiday Inn, probably around year 2000, when we were doing the scoping, you invited me to give an orientation as to where we were headed, what the process was, and what we were going to do. So it's kind of interesting that here we are at the same place, and now the draft management plan is on the street. What I'd like to do, if it's okay, is go through the presentation. I think it'll take about 20 minutes, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. If you feel you need to ask a question during, for clarification during the presentation, I'll certainly entertain it. But just to be sure that I can get through within the allotted time period, I'd appreciate holding questions till afterwards. We all know, here where the sanctuary is relative to the Gulf of Maine, and oops, excuse me. Just to refresh your sense of the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary is one of 13 National Marine Sanctuaries in the system, plus one Marine National Monument in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. The sanctuary program is in the Office of Marine Sanctuaries, which is in the National Ocean Service within NOAA. And the sanctuary program is established by Act, by the National Marine Sanctuary Act. It was passed in 1972. I don't expect everybody to read all of this. I just indicate that the purposes and policies of the Act, there's nine of them. I just present four here. The first one is that the sanctuaries are designated because they are special national significance. The Act provides authority for comprehensive and coordinated conservation. The Act directs the sanctuaries to maintain the natural biological communities. And it also directs the sanctuaries to facilitate to the extent compatible with the primary objective of resource protection. This sanctuary has as its mission essentially three things. It's established to conserve, protect, and enhance the biodiversity, the ecological integrity, and the cultural legacy of the sanctuary while allowing for compatible use. We view it as a three-legged stool. On one leg, we see marine mammals. On another leg, we see historic maritime resources. And as a third, we see the whole assemble of the diverse biology there. Now, this process of preparing the draft management plan, it's been a public collaboration of enormous proportion. During scoping, we had over 20,000 comments that we received. We had more than 300 people involved in the scoping meetings. We had over 200 people who served on issue-driven working groups. These were working groups set up by our advisory council, but it wasn't just advisory council members. It was members of the diverse communities that the sanctuary views as their constituents. The entire process was coordinated with and reviewed by 45 members and alternatives on the Sanctuary Advisory Council during the 2002-2006 period. And the council has representation from Connecticut to Maine. The draft management plan, first of all, it's an exploration and a rediscovery of the sanctuary. The first management plan, and the only one up to now, was published in 1993, 1 year after designation of the sanctuary in 92. Since then, there's a lot that's happened, and there's a lot to have been discovered. The plan advocates for a higher level of conservation in the sanctuary than elsewhere in the Gulf of Maine. Now, this management plan is NOAA's draft management plan for the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. NOAA is advocating for a higher level of conservation within the sanctuary than elsewhere in the Gulf of Maine. The plan seeks to manage sanctuary resources for biodiversity conservation and resource protection. and it stipulates that human uses be compatible with resource protection. The briefing I'm providing now, I've concentrated primarily on the aspects that relate to fishing that may have some direct interest to the council. This first image depicts the spatial fishing patterns within the sanctuary. Now, this is information from the vessel trip reports that are filed to NOAA Fisheries. We've broken it out by mobile gear, fixed gear, party and charter gear. Would you see? Sorry, I'm blinding myself. Mobile gear, fixed gear, and party charter gear, and then all gears combined. Now, this information is for the year 2001-2002. Now, we chose that for the reason that we did a fishery independent standardized survey of the sanctuary during that time period. So that in part of the plan process, we actually validated whether or not the vessel trip report information that was provided for activities within the sanctuary actually compared well with standardized survey results, and they did. So this is why we've chosen this particular year as the validating or as the standardization to give folks a sense of what the fishing patterns are. And the conclusion is that virtually every square kilometer of the sanctuary is impacted by fishing by one form or another to one degree or another at one time or another during the year. Now, we know that from 1996 to 2005, which is the decade over which we've used the vessel trip report to do additional analyses, this is midway through that time period, and we know there's been change over that decade, so it's been difficult to say any one year is representative of that decade, but we think this is a fair representation. And of note, even though the Western Gulf of Maine closure area overlaps the sanctuary, you can see that there is fishing activity there, mostly in the form of recreational midwater trawling and that sort. We also looked at, well, what's the distribution of the commercial landings? We know where fishing efforts being applied within the sanctuary by what gear type. Well, where are the landings brought to port? And you can see that there's four states from Maine down to Rhode Island involving 15 counties. We've aggregated the data by county rather than by port, just for reasons to keep the information generalized. The county that has the highest landings is Essex County, which of course includes Gloucester, but also Plymouth and Barnstable. We also looked at the same thing for party charter boat landings. On the left, we have the party boat landings, and again, it's a little hard for everybody to see the numbers, but the Essex County, again, received the largest share, 68% of the party boat landings, and on the right, we have the charter boat landings, and here, there's a switch down to Plymouth County. They realized about 68% of the landings. So this is useful information in ways of identifying what the major constituent interests are in these four states and the ports that access and use the sanctuary for fishing. Now, this unfortunately, this is not a bigger image. What this shows is the cumulative impacts caused by fishing in the sanctuary. And at the very top, of course, we have fishing. On this side, we have fishing mortality. And on this side, we have collateral impacts. Fishing mortality, has population effects. Collateral impacts involve habitat damage and bycatch, and habitat damage can lead to incidental mortality. Now, all of this feeds into community interactions. Now, I show you this not to, indicate the linkages per se, because I'm sure you all know this. What I want to demonstrate with this slide is that these things up here, the fishing mortality, the habitat, the bycatch, these are all the issues and the problems that Magnuson and the Fish Council is working with, working to resolve. The sanctuary, because we're looking at biodiversity conservation, because we're primarily concerned with community interactions, this is the level where we're primarily working. All of this leads to altered ecological integrity within the sanctuary. We are very, very dependent upon the decisions that this body makes, and we need to work complementary with you folks and in collaboration with you folks if we're going to be successful in managing the sanctuary to provide protection for the biological communities that are there. Biological communities made up of populations and habitat. And these are the areas that you folks are putting most of your attention in. We would like to become engaged in the process so that we can start providing some feedback as to what the results of your actions may mean in terms of the impacts on the communities, the biological communities of the sanctuary, which we're trying to manage. Now, this is a generalized picture of circulation patterns in the Gulf of Maine, and you can see essentially that we have the main coastal current that comes around. This is Massachusetts Bay. You can barely make out Stellwagen Bank, but there's a circulation that goes like that. Some of it goes down, around the Cape. Some of it goes out to the Great South Channel of Georges Bank, and some of it, goes around. Well, Jim Manning, NOAA Fisheries, the work he's been doing with Drifter Boys, it actually matches extremely well that general depiction of circulation. And I'm showing you this because it indicates that the sanctuary is very, very closely connected with the rest of the Gulf of Maine. Here we're looking at a buoy that was released up here off Maine. It comes right down, the sanctuary is right there, and it goes out the Great South Channel of Georges Banks. Here's one that's actually released just west of the sanctuary, goes through the sanctuary, goes back out into the central Gulf of Maine. And here's one that's released up off of around Gloucester, goes through the sanctuary, and it goes down around Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, the islands below. The sanctuary is both a sink and a source of larvae. The sanctuary is intimately connected and interacts with a lot of the processes within the Gulf of Maine, including recruitment. Now, one of the things that makes the sanctuary special, makes it work, is its habitat diversity. It's got four major habitats within the sanctuary, gravel, mud, sand, plus what's not indicated here is boulder reefs. Boulder reefs are often associated with the gravel habitats. These are the same basic habitat types for the rest of the Gulf of Maine. This is both of these are paintings from professional scientific illustrators that looked at hundreds of hours of remotely operated vehicle video taken from within the sanctuary. And this is a depiction of what the boulder reef habitats community looks like, and this is what the anemone forests on the fringe and the muddy basins looks like. One of the things that we're striving to do is depict by the use of landscape painting what the underwater landscapes and the habitats of the sanctuary look like. It's very difficult to do it with single videos or photographs. But this habitat diversity results in a great deal of biodiversity. A relatively large share of the biodiversity within the entire Gulf of Maine is represented within the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary. So well over 575 known species. Those are just the known species. And that's everything from, we're looking in the plant, everything from the protists, which are your single-celled species that are so important in primary production within the sanctuary. There's virtually no fixed algae in the sanctuary. All of the carbon fixing that goes on derives from these, virtually all of it from the water column events. Everything from these single-celled organisms up to the great whales and the entire range of diversity in between. Maintaining and conserving this biodiversity we see as the primary responsibility of the sanctuary. Now, one of the things we have to do is we have the metrics to measure it. This is an example of fish species richness. It's just one of a half a dozen measures of diversity that we use to characterize biodiversity. We have it, you can see the range of species, we're representative species we're talking about. It's not just the fish that you folks are struggling to manage. It's not just the gadoids. It's not the fish that constitute seafood. We're looking at a lot of the entire range of species of fish that are out there. And when you do that, you notice that the sanctuary, indicated by red, it's among the areas of the Gulf of Maine that have the greatest fish species richness. Now, there is a long history and long traditions of fishing within the sanctuary area. This is a map Captain John Smith developed in 1614. It's a remarkably good map, given what he had to work with. One of the things that we did was on this map, working with the University of New Hampshire, History of Marine Animal Populations, they asked them, well, where would the sanctuary be? Well, you can see the sanctuary is right in that area. And there's a sailing ship right there. What that sailing ship indicated at that time was this is a good place to fish. So back in 1614, John Smith was saying Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary is a good place to fish. When he did a second addition to this map in 1635, he put a pile of cod heads underneath the ship. And what that meant was Stellwagen Bank is a damn good place to go fishing. So it was recognized way back when, pre-colonial times, that this was a place that was worthy of interest. Well, there's been a lot of interest that has been applied to the sanctuary. And one of the things that we're looking at, and I reported it to you earlier, these number of years ago when we met, was that fishing is having an impact on habitat. So how do we determine what that impact is? We're looking at the four habitat types that I mentioned. We're looking at site within the Western Gulf of Maine closure, which is relatively restricted, to a comparable site outside of the Western Gulf of Maine closure, but within the sanctuary. And when we started that in 1998, and we have information analyzed for certain of those habitats through 2005. Now, this gives you an example of a gravel habitat at 65 meters inside and outside of the sliver. This is outside, and this is inside. Now, this is not before and after, okay? And these are not the same sites. These are the replicate sites in each of the study areas for that habitat type. But it's quite instructive to look at this. The biodiversity is much higher here than it is here, okay? The regrowth of epibenthic structure is much greater in the area that you folks have protected than in the area within the sanctuary that has not been protected. Since our major goal here is to promote the protection, the maintenance, and the restoration of biodiversity within the sanctuary, this knowledge is very important to us as it is to you. The work that's going on in muddy basins, we can't even see a difference yet in the 7 years, and we're probably looking on the order of more than a decade before we'll start detecting some statistical significance inside and outside the areas for that habitat type. Now, another very important fact is that the many years of fishing within the sanctuary area has resulted in a reduction in the maximum length of many of the fish that are out there. This is analysis looking at 15 species of white hake, cod, pollock, all the way over to dogfish, that are within the sanctuary area that are based on the NOAA Fisheries Experimental Trawl data. Again, a fishery-independent data. And what it shows is that for all of these species, from 1963 to 2000, that there was a decrease in the size of the largest fish. For some of these species, like white hake, it was on the order of 50%. Cod, it was on the order of 27%. This gives you some idea of what that means in relative terms. 50% reduction amongst the size of your largest fish can have a great impact on the community structure. A reduction of 27%, evidenced by cod, can have a great impact on the biological communities within the sanctuary because of the effect on predation, predominantly, but also competition. These fish that are so important as seafood within this region are also enormously important as biological agents that structure marine communities. And when you have a much bigger mouth, Okay, you can feed on much bigger prey and a much greater range of prey. When you reduce the size of those large fish to smaller fish, prey can outgrow the risk of predation. They can actually realize a refuge from predation when they can outgrow the size of the fish that normally would feed on them. And that can have a lot of cascading effects on the type and nature of the biological community. Now, that information only went to 2000. What we wanted to do was also look at, well, what's happened since then. For seven of those species, we had data from another analysis that enabled us to extend it from 1990, to redo it from 1990 to 2005. In a nutshell, everything that's still decreasing is white hake and your flatfishes. In the case of cod, we're actually beginning to see what might be a recovery in the sense that the larger size of the fish is reversing, and in the case of haddock, that was statistically significant. So there is cause for some optimism. But this is an aspect of fishery management that has a great deal of importance on sanctuary management. The classical, conventional way in which you manage fisheries based on the surplus production removes a lot of the old fish. Fish above a certain size. Okay, that is going to have a lot of impact on biological communities. And there's another whole phenomenon called BOFFs, the big old fat females. You're probably all aware of that in terms of not only the number of eggs that it produces, but the quality of the eggs and the survivorship of the larvae from these bigger, older females is significantly different. It improves with age. Key prey species. The sanctuary functions essentially for two reasons. One, the physiography of the bank, the geology, that affects the mixing, it affects the currents, the recruitment, the primary production. The second aspect is the prey. It's the sand lance and the herring within the sanctuary that attract the whales, that sustain the life at the site, that are so important to everything out there, codfish to seabirds. The key prey species we've been able to look at it in great detail and appreciate the importance of this species within the sanctuary, the ecosystem function of the sanctuary is sandlands. What this map shows here, based on 25 years of data, that the abundance of sandlands within the sanctuary is actually the highest anywhere within the southwestern part of the Gulf of Maine. It's also relatively high, Great South Channel, and out to George's Banks. But Stellwagen is where sand lance are happening. And, of course, this is a picture of a sand lance. Now, this is the distribution based on 30 years of information of where humpback whales are distributed. And you can see, again, the sanctuary here is amongst one of the areas where it's the highest distribution of humpback whales. Notice the similarity to the previous slide of where those whales are. Independent modeling, looking at what is that predicts what factors cause the whales to be where, indicates that sand lance is one of the primary predictors for the distribution of humpback whales, and one of the primary reasons that the whales come to the sanctuary. Now, this is an example, and you're not going to be able to see it. There's a video here. I'll run it, and we can talk about it. We're tagging whales with very sophisticated equipment where the water essentially disappears. We're studying whales like they're birds in trees. And what we find from this analysis that the whales operate strategically in the way that they feed. There's daytime and nighttime differences, and they behave differently when the sand lance are in patches and when they're not. And what they're doing is they're optimally choosing those patches that are columnar in nature, that are deep, that are round, and that are high abundance. And then they're circling them. When you see bubble net feeding out there, and you see this is an example of bubble net feeding of two whales. But the key point is that it's not just the abundance of the prey, it's the nature of the prey field. And that's what this line is here. This is an acoustic recording of a sand lance that these tag whales were feeding on. So one of the things that the sanctuary feels is really necessary is protection of the forage base within the sanctuary. this is one reason, the whales, but it has to do with all of the other species. Now, talking of whales, whales are also impacted by fishing activities. Marine mammal entanglement, you know, is a problem. There's mitigations that are on the way, changing in the case of lobster gear from floating line to sinking line, you know, which we applaud, and which our whale tagging actually indicates it's a very reasonable mitigation to adopt. But nonetheless, what this shows you is the reported sightings of entangled whales within the Gulf of Maine, 41% of which occur within the sanctuary area. What this shows in the dark green, right, it shows the highest number of fixed gear permits to the, essentially the white is lowest number. The sanctuary area has the highest number of fixed gear fishing permits anywhere along the eastern seaboard of the United States. So the risk for entanglement is exceptionally high in the sanctuary area. The sanctuary area is a primary destination, feeding destination of a number of endangered species of whales. So this continues to be a concern to the sanctuary. Recently, in the last 2 years, with the resurgence of sand lance within the sanctuary, there's been a high number of tuna that have come in. In the past year in particular, there also has been a high number of interactions between tuna fishing and the whales. This shows the distribution of where bluefin tuna were caught by the dots and the distribution of humpback whales. And there is, not surprisingly, since they're feeding oftentimes on related prey, there's close association. That has resulted in humpback whales being caught in a tuna troll gear. Has there been a lot? No. But has there been some? Yes. Has it resulted in problems? Yes. When clients on whale watch boats see this, they call the disentanglement hotline, and they flood the disentanglement hotline so it's no longer functional. So when you do have a whale that's tangled in lobster gear or gillnet gear or long neck line gear that they can successfully disentangle, that information does not get to the people who need to know. So that's a concern. It's also a concern that whales are being hooked, and we're hopeful that some change in practice can diminish that. The sanctuary also is the site of numerous historical shipwrecks, and of the 18 historic shipwrecks documented to date, 11 of them are heavily impacted with fishing gear. Everything from trawls to gill nets to braid fishing line that has been a problem in that it entangles the propellers on the ROVs that we use, that the archaeologists use to study the sites. But it also includes recreational fishing, jigs and such, which in many cases, the shipwrecks are not in a condition where they're heavily impacted by jigs, but certain of them, like the Portland, where you have fine bone china out on the upper deck, could easily be destroyed by heavy jigs. These are just examples of three of the shipwreck sites that are on the National Register of Historic Places, the Portland, the Paul Palmer, and the wreck of the Palmer Quarry. As a summary, 10 of 17 categories within the sanctuary resource category have been rated fair through poor based on the analyses and the work within this management plan. If this were a report card, the sanctuary would give the sanctuary resources condition a C-. There's room for a lot of improvement, and we really don't feel that the status quo is acceptable. That brings us to proposed management continuum. I hope all of you have had a chance to glance at the plan. We sent it to you. Hopefully in time you would get it before this meeting. You'll see that there's the forefront part of the plan is the findings and the facts, and the latter part is the action plans. And you'll also notice that the document doesn't have an EIS. It's an EA. It's a non-regulatory policy framework. The work that needs to be done is there's some guidance offered in the action plans, but it's really the next steps. What this indicates very briefly is that the next management plan review is tentatively scheduled for about 2013, 5 years from the time the final plan comes out. There's a number of actions within the action plan that says that there should be a whale watch program that might consider regulations amongst the best practices that are established. There should be a maritime heritage program in which certain activities relative to historic shipwrecks should be either curtailed or managed in some way. There's proposal, the recommendation that the sanctuary should come to the Fish Council and the National Marine Fisheries Service to prohibit the take of sand lance within the sanctuary and to deal with forage-based management in the context of ecosystem-based management. And there's work to be done in habitat zoning and with compatibility analysis. I mentioned the term compatible, that the sanctuary is supposed to be facilitating uses that are compatible with the primary goal of resource protection, but we don't have any guidelines or standards or criteria within the National Marine Sanctuary Act that determines what that is. So there is a process that's been identified through this management plan review process that we will want to be demonstrating. The action plans, there's 11 of them. They address the priority needs in the following four programmatic areas. First is capacity building. There's administrative capacity. We need better cooperation with other agencies, public outreach and education, compatibility determination. In the area of ecosystem protection, we need to embark on ecosystem-based sanctuary management. We need to address ecosystem alteration. We need to continue to work to ensure that the water quality within the sanctuary is good. In terms of marine mammal protection, we need to deal with continuing issues involving behavioral disturbance, with marine mammal vessel strikes, with marine mammal entanglement. And there's the issue of how do we manage our maritime heritage resources. We have 8 public meetings scheduled in 4 states. The first one is tonight here in Portland, all the way until June 19th, so essentially over this next 2 weeks, that'll be in Mystic, Connecticut. And we really encourage all of you to, you know, please comment, either collectively or individually, particularly through your memberships. We want to hear what you think. The closing date for public comments is August 4th. So that's all I have in the briefing, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Craig. Just to remind everybody, this is not a public hearing.
Oh, thank you.
Although, as you pointed out, there is one scheduled tonight here in Portland.
Yeah, very, very good, John. Thank you.
And I'll entertain some comments and questions from the council. Mike Leary.
Thank you. That was a good presentation. I was wondering, since the Stillwater Bank has become a sanctuary, they've had to the west the outfall pipe, the sanitation pipe, and to the north just recently the LNG pipe. To what extent do you think this had a role in the ecosystem on the Stillwater Bank?
What we did was for 5 years we we extended the monitoring sites within the sanctuary for water quality to integrate it with the work that MWRA was doing. And when you look at those results, the water quality, interestingly enough, was the only resource category that we thought was in good shape. We could not detect any problem in terms of eutrophication. When the National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science looked at the sediments from Boston Harbor out to the sanctuary that could also have been impacted by the outfall, they found an improving situation. So we don't believe that the discharge from the outfall is negatively impacting the water quality of the sanctuary. In the case of the LNG, that's outside the sanctuary. Our major concern with its licensing had been the acoustic problems that could arise, essentially with noise. However, we are coordinating with the state, several state agencies, tracking, being sure that their discharge rates and their uptake rates do not differ from what was licensed pursuant to the EIS. Okay.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that presentation. I learned a bunch of things. I had one question, which I'm going to just throw out there and for discussion anyway. I think you partially answered why I think it's surfaced as an issue, and that has to do with the picture you showed of the whale with the troll tuna gear. caught on it. You know, I've seen in the Stellwagen banknotes, and I've seen that picture, and it somehow seemed like you were focusing in on sort of one fishing method that probably, when you look at the thousands of boats that are out there doing it and the thousands of days that they are out there doing it, is probably very, very low incidence of interaction between the two. And as is true with a lot of the gear entanglements, I would say probably all of them, it's not intentional. I think a tuna fisherman losing his gear, those things are fairly expensive, and they're not out there attempting to hook the whales. Yes, they're fishing in the same area, and it happens. But, I mean, I was concerned that you were taking or looking at one method of fishing that seems like, in an overall sense, would have relatively low impacts to the kinds of things that you talked about in your cumulative impact slide, you know, focusing on some of the habitat and those kinds of issues. So that was, it's just sort of a concern. The issue of the size of the fish decreasing, I guess I would have to say that the wording of that seems to indicate that the fish just in the sanctuary are smaller versus what's happening to them throughout the Gulf of Maine or even, you know, outside on George's Bank. So I would say that there should probably be some comparison as to what is going on a larger scale and to see how that compares. And we got some information yesterday that indicates that kind of decrease in growth is seems to be evident throughout the region. Also in the plan, you talked somewhat about the value of the party charter fleet, and it didn't appear to me anyway that you were using any kind of the normal multipliers that should be used, so that people that come, whether they're on a charter boat or whatever, are they've got, you know, travel expenses, and they use restaurants, they stay in hotels, so there should be a multiplier effect to that value, and I didn't see where there was any incorporation of the economic impact from the private recreational user as well. And we know that looking at some of the fishery statistics, that the recreational guy is, you know, in terms of numbers, may be substantially greater than what we're seeing with the party charter fleet. So that's something that perhaps should also get incorporated.
Well, I certainly appreciate that input. And please, if you're during the comment period, if you could provide that. You know, as John indicated, this isn't, you know, the meeting where those comments are getting recorded for us to respond to. So I would appreciate it if you'd please send them to us. If I had just a moment, if I could just touch on each of those, if I can just remember them. The first one with the entanglement of the tuna with the fixed gear, we recognize that it's not an activity that's occurring in large number. But it takes on particular significance. First of all, it's very apparent there's a million people going whale watching out there. There's a large number of people, recreational boaters, fishermen who are also out there who see that. There's the very important sense or aspect of the whale population that visits the sanctuary. It is preferentially lactating and pregnant females and nursing calves. There are about half a dozen feeding areas within the North Atlantic that the humpback whale population go to. Stellwagen is the only one that is preferentially lactating pregnant females, and yeah, it's a nursery. It's the major nursery in the North Atlantic. The chance that a whale could be hooked, blowhole, the eye, it could be a calf, these are things that could be easily avoided. So we're not trying to make it the poster child of entanglement. You saw we also had the gill net that was wrapped around the tail. So we do recognize it. What we also want to do is we think that this is something that can easily be addressed, and it's something we hope that we can work with the fishing community to deal with. In terms of the economics, this is if there was an EIS attached to this and there were regulations, we would have done the total complete impact analysis, economic impact analysis, but there isn't. It's an EA. And what we're striving to do was to, as a first order of economic value, just do a characterization of what the uses were. So just as we were trying to characterize where the uses were occurring, we're looking to give some indication of what the first order economic value was. But I assure you, if it had gone to regulations and EIS, the fuller analysis would have been done. And I take what you say entirely. I think you're entirely correct.
Dave Gaethel.
Report was interesting. I've done a quick read of your book here. You know, it's a pretty good-sized document. And I got a few pages in front of me I had to read the last couple weeks. But I did have a few issues. I talked to Jeff Pike yesterday. I don't know if do you know Jeff?
I don't.
All right. Well, he was Congressman Studd's aide when the sanctuary was set up. He was the one who actually wrote the text. And I wanted to check and make sure that I was right. And I didn't see it in here, kind of a history of how this was formed and some of the issues concerning fishing. And what he told me was, and he couldn't be here this afternoon, he had another commitment, but he said a condition of setting up the sanctuary was that there would be no prohibition on fishing unless done by the councils. So, and I believe that's still in effect. So, as you said, we will have to work together in anything that you wish to go forward with in terms of fishing closures or anything like that, habitat closures, whatever, that would impact mobile gear. Along with that, when I've read the document appears at first glance to be a scientific document. It's heavily footnoted, it's annotated, but I really think it's more of an advocacy document. It does say on the cover, draft management plan. And I think you should make a statement to be clear that it's an advocacy document, not a reference document, because there are a number of statements in here that are advocacy statements. I would call them advocacy statements. I don't want to say they're not based on science. Some of them have been drawn selectively from scientific reports, but there's only one side of the science presented, especially on the habitat stuff. There's one particular statement in here on page 55, likens trawling to a clear cut in the forest. I mean, that's like waving a red flag in front of a bull for me. That's not a widely accepted scientific statement. I think there are more scientists who would dispute that than would agree with it. And it does, to your credit, later on you mentioned the National Research Council and the study on the effects of trawling, which I testified for and presented a paper to. And again, I would like to see kind of some balance, perhaps present that information, which for a trawl door, the true weight of a trawl door on the bottom is roughly, in terms of pounds per square inch, 1/10 of a human footprint on land. So when it says, trawl doors are typically 1,000 pounds, this and that, makes it sound like you're dragging a 1,000-pound piece of steel across your front yard. Dragging a trawl door across the bottom is very different from dragging the same trawl door across your front yard. It's an aerodynamic piece of equipment. It's very light on the bottom. Those types of things. And I think another suggestion I have for you is with the wrecks. Publish a list of the latitudes and longitudes of the wrecks. I don't know a mobile gear fisherman on this planet that wants to get in a wreck. I don't know where some of those wrecks are. I've been in two wrecks down there. I don't fish down there all the time. I don't know which ones I was in. Fishermen, guide their wreck books. It's kind of like, there goes that sucker into that one. Publish them. I realize recreational fishermen may go fish on them, but the damage from the jig going down on them is a lot less than the damage of me getting wrapped around them. Plus, I'd really like to go home alive, and a lot of people who get in wrecks don't. the issue of the fish that Rip already raised, if you stick around until my report, which is the next one after this, we actually will have 8 habitat reports peer-reviewed and 1 study on this specific area done by Wes Kaufman, who I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read you a little bit of this because we did peer-review it and accept it. It said, in sum, there is strong correlation between the Western Gulf of Maine closed area and fish catches, both for dogfish specifically and for the community as a whole. The original hypothesis of higher biomass and fish numbers within the closure across the board was rejected. Some fish species were at higher biomass inside the closure, and others were at higher biomass outside the closure. And many others either showed no effect or could not be assessed with the limited numbers caught. As to the size, the same thing was noted. Actually, the average size, because they took link frequencies on all of them, was larger outside the closed area than inside it. And as part of our review, we found that this was really only a snapshot. It did not represent, it could only be used as a snapshot. It couldn't be used to make conclusive statements, but that it tended to reject the hypothesis that there were larger fish in closed areas than outside of closed areas. And that we can make available to you at the close of this meeting. There are also a number of other habitat studies here on bottom, effects of trawling in closed areas versus not unclosed. You can take a whole armload with you when you leave. The last thing I wanted to touch on, I know we're constrained for time. Somewhere else I read in the document, I don't have the exact page number, that you received, I think it was 20,000 comments. And I'm very concerned that I think it was Hamilton to paraphrase the Federalist Papers, that it is the job of government to prevent a tyranny of the majority. If we turn this into a election, and you know we put this document out there, and then we say, well, okay, what should be done? Well, I mean, there are people in this room that can go hit a button on a computer tonight, and they can have 20,000 postcards on your desk tomorrow morning saying, throw the fishermen out of there, or you know, whatever they want that postcard to say. And I think it's your job as a government official to make sure, just as it's our job as government, quasi-government officials, to make sure that we don't allow the tyranny of the majority to overcome the rights of the minority. So thank you.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Craig. Good to see you here. As you know, I'm a member of the Stowagon Bank Advisory Council, and I'm going to be very much involved in the continued development of this plan and the, well, carrying out of some of the work that's described in the work plan. For example, I'm on the zoning working group, and I look forward to that initiative. I congratulate you for getting this plan done. It was not an easy task. It was extremely challenging. You and your staff did a great job to get it done and out for public review. It's certainly going to stimulate a lot of discussion. It raises a lot of important issues, some that I really have supported in a major way, such as the point you raised in the document about the big old Vicun females, that is codfish specifically, and what we need to address regarding the protection of large codfish. That's very consistent with what the Division of Marine Fisheries has done in our own state waters relative to a cod conservation zone. And that particular initiative, by the way, mentions specifically the Stowagon Bank Sanctuary and the relationship between the sanctuary and our cod conservation zone and other areas. So I'm very glad you got into that, and it's going to be some good food for thought and will generate a great deal of discussion. However, I do have a couple of concerns that I wanted to raise for your benefit, and it's very specific to council interests, so I raise them here. And that specifically relates, those comments specifically relate to, number one, the executive summary, which everyone obviously first goes to. And I look in the executive summary, and I really don't see any reference to the New England Fishery Management Council and the need for us to work together as partners, to be allies in conservation, to be allies in habitat protection. We know it's important. You acknowledge it in the document someplace. But still, in the executive summary, if it was there, I would have felt much more comfortable. You're acknowledging up front the need for us to work in tandem for us to assist you achieve your specific objectives. What disturbed me in the executive summary was your actual reference to the fact that it's likely that initiatives relative to resource protection, preventing local depletion of key forage species, and instituting requirements for habitat zoning, that will likely require an amendment to the designation document of the sanctuary to give the sanctuary greater authority over management of the resources within the sanctuary. So that it sends the wrong signal. You know, the tone and the tenor is not right. That's what bothered me. In addition, when you go to the synopsis, okay, the last chapter of this document, and you see the conclusions that the document draws, you can't help but come away with the conclusion that the sanctuary, through this document, is condemning fishing and is saying that fishing within the sanctuary is an incompatible use, and that indeed fishing within the sanctuary is bankrupting the sanctuary. Now, I don't agree with that, and I don't think those are your conclusions, really, from all the discussions I've had with you over the years, but you can't help but come away with those conclusions. And frankly, it's already led to the conclusion by the news media that fishing should be seriously controlled within the sanctuary, maybe even outlawed. And I know that some environmental organizations, very respected environmental organizations, such as the Conservation Law Foundation, are already moving forward to generate a campaign to have the sanctuary made a refuge. So, again, the wrong message. What I like about this document, and I've always liked about this document, is that it has some very well put together, very well thought out action plans that many people developed. You've acknowledged some of those people here today. I thought that when this plan was going to be developed and out for review, that the emphasis would be on the action plans, but it really isn't. The action plans are pretty much appendices to the document, and you have to go there to find out what actually is now going to be done. Unfortunately, much of the text that precedes the action plans draws conclusions before strategies are implemented to determine what the conclusion should be. So I offer that up as just some concern of mine. I have the greatest of respect for the sanctuary. Fine work, a lot of additional work will be done in the sanctuary relative to the action plan. Work with this council, which is critical. So I just emphasize that you please work with us, and by working with us, we can accomplish some great things for the sanctuary. And then finally, my question to you would be, your NOAA and NOAA Fisheries exists, of course. We know NOAA Fisheries very well. Partner in our crimes and our accomplishments. Has NOAA Fisheries, in particular the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, commented on this document already, especially points in this document that relate to fisheries issues, fisheries research? And if they have commented on the document already, are those comments available for us to review?
Okay, well, to answer your question, NOAA Fisheries was very extensively involved in the review of this document. The internal NOAA review took on the order of 14 months, and there was a lot of opportunity for all of the agencies within NOAA that had interest to participate, and we were very fortunate to receive extensive feedback from NOAA Fisheries at both the Gloucester level, the Science Center level, also at the D.C. level, and at Silver Spring. So it's when I said this plan was NOAA's draft management plan for the sanctuary, I meant it. This is not just NOS issuing a condition report. It's not just the sanctuary issuing a notice. This is NOAA's approved draft management plan for the Stillwagon Bank National Sanctuary.
Are those comments available, the critique of the document? Because I'm sure the council would like to see those comments, because it'll shortstop us. It'll probably provide answers to questions we would otherwise ask, and it'll save you some time if we just have those comments.
I think, unfortunately, the answer is no, because once the plan goes in for internal NOAA review, it's considered an all discussions are internal, and that's to facilitate a free and easy exchange between all of the affected parties. Because as you imagine, there were very diverse views that were involved in the the review process. So no, unfortunately, that's not. However, I might add, if NOAA Fisheries or any other federal agency offers comment during the public comment period, then those comments and our reply to those comments are part of the public record.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. My beef is fairly simple. The picture on page 16 of the whale, I don't want to leave that just yet because it's been mentioned twice, but I don't want to leave it just yet. Any picture of a whale that is shown with any kind of damage is going to automatically become highly emotional. And this particular picture shows, well, if you want to do something emotional that I think would be much more appropriate, show a whale after it's been hammered by a big vessel. But this one, I've towed those daisy chains over thousands of miles of ocean over the last 30 years, and in the vicinity of whales and a lot of boats, and I have never once seen a whale grab any or any marine mammal grab any tuna bait. They've got big brains; they're much too smart for that. And it almost implies, the picture implies to me that this whale had grabbed at this thing. I know it's not true, but that's what the picture seems to imply. It's something that doesn't happen in all of those years and all of those thousands of miles on the ocean. I have only seen a marine mammal snagged by trolled tuna gear one time, and that was a white-sided dolphin, which immediately jumped and extricated itself. So I would submit that this is an extremely rare occurrence. The individual, whoever was trolling that, probably had the gear out much too far behind his boat anyway for this to happen. Probably not a competent operator. But I just can't see that as being something that you would normally see. And I think that given the fact that whales incite so much emotion in people, rightly so, but I mean that they do, that the use of the picture is slanted, that it just gives the wrong message. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the input. There's a new dimension that has emerged in this last year. It became apparent in terms of the relationship between not all tuna fishermen, but certain tuna fishermen are beginning to use the whale watch boats, okay, as a way to find where the whales are, to find where the forage is that the bluefin tuna may be feeding on. And there have actually been vociferous interactions that have been recorded, have been documented, have been reported to Officer Law Enforcement, where fishermen are yelling at the whale watch boat, "This is my whale, get away from it." So there is a sense, okay, that what we'd like to do is we'd just like to flag this. We think there's a very reasonable way to approach this. We know this hasn't been a problem in the past. We were surprised to see this begin happening, but it's happening, and it's been increasing from last year to this year, and we are expecting another good year for sand lance and whales out there this year, and we want to be very vigilant to document, is this an increasing phenomenon? Anything anybody can within the industry can do to encourage, you know, folks not to fish on whales, not to troll through bubble clouds and bubble nets, is only going to help the problem. Okay. We can talk more. I'd be happy to talk to anyone additionally afterwards. Okay.
Craig, I had a question to that point. We don't regulate tuna fishing. So do you plan to present this information to the body that has the authority over that?
No. Right now, we check with NOAA, Office of Law Enforcement. A hooked whale, like in that picture, is considered a violation of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And if that was actually documented or there was a law enforcement officer there at the time, that person could be charged under that act. So, no, we're not. We think there's that protection. We think a more successful way, there's a recommendation that was made during the working group process to consider regulating vessels, okay, transiting through bubble nets and bubble clouds. And that's something that we might like to give some attention to, Because under the sanctuary designation document, certain classes of vessel do fall under our management.
Okay. I had somebody over here. Doug.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. I just had a brief question. At the beginning of your presentation, you made the statement that you want to become engaged with the Fisheries Management Council management process. And outside of this meeting, how do you or does this plan envision you becoming engaged over the long term with us?
Well, first of all, one of the institutional factors that makes us a little difficult for us to interact with you folks is the only opportunity we have to offer comment on regulations or on actions that might impact us is at the same time that the public does. Okay, we don't have an opportunity to, as when this plan was being reviewed, we don't have an opportunity to really interact before your recommendations get out to the public. One of the recommendations in the plan is to establish a more formal relationship with NOAA Fisheries to enable the two agencies to talk more about the issues that you folks are dealing with, so that when you make a recommendation, it's something we've already had a chance to chew on and to offer some input on. So that's institutionally we're looking for a change, a way in which the process, we're involved in the process a little sooner than the public is, so that you can get the sense of what our views are. This would be with NOAA Fisheries. They can share them with you. Hopefully, I can become more available to interact, at the meetings. Members of our staff, and this is one of our problems, is we're a small staff. Ben Haskell is already on your Habitat Advisory Committee. There may be opportunities for us to become more involved at that level as well. But what we would be hoping is that if we can get out in front of the actual decision-making process, where we can offer what our views or our concerns or some suggestions, so that you folks can have the opportunity to chew on it, prior to us just having to become a member of the public saying we're for or against or we'd like to see this different, that would be very helpful. An example, in our advisory council, we have the Sanctuary Advisory Council, NOAA Fisheries, Paul, the Fishery Council, they sit on that. There's a lot of opportunity to dialogue and to participate in working groups. Now, there's some parallel opportunities in the council process, but if anything became clear to me during the review process, the internal NOAA review process, it was enormously helpful to have the opportunity to talk about things before it actually got to the point where it went to the public for review. And that's not to circumvent in any way the public review. It's just that there's, as I'd indicated in that slide, virtually everything you folks do is having ramifications on sanctuary management. So if there's a way, we can't be involved in everything, but there may be some priority issues that we could. And if we'd appreciate if you could flag us, because you have a better sense of really where things may be going, you could say, this is probably going to have an impact on the sanctuary. We need to bring this to their attention. Another thing that's recommended in the plan is, as you're producing your charts and your maps, if routinely you can include the sanctuary boundary in your maps and charts. Sometimes we feel that you're making decisions on the Gulf of Maine wide on the regional basis, and sometimes we're lost in the discussion, in part because we're not remembered that we're there. So there's some little things that are procedural that I think would go a long way to improve communication.
Would attending some of the committee meetings be sufficient to have that interaction at that point?
Well, that's certainly a good place to begin. It certainly is, because those are people reporting to you. But we also need to have, an opportunity to work more formally with NOAA Fisheries in matters that relate to the issues that the council is dealing with. So it's a combination of things.
I want to clear one thing up. I think I heard you say you want an opportunity to participate in our process before it goes out to the public for comment. But the issues and the alternatives we develop are developed in the public. It's part of a public process. It's not like alternatives are developed behind closed doors and then we go out to the public and ask for their comment on it.
No, I didn't mean to imply that.
Okay.
But there's need of more opportunity for us to converse with NOAA Fisheries and with you folks on the issues of mutual interest. We'd like to formalize that to some degree. If I misspoke, I apologize.
I was just trying to understand what it was you're seeking to get along with NOAA Fisheries better, have a better.
Well, and with you folks as well. I think if we are able to raise our issues and our concerns perhaps more frequently with you folks in a greater variety of ways, I think that would go a long way. I mean, just the discussion around the table today I found very helpful.
Okay. Could you remind me again, tonight there's a public hearing?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's tonight. It's at the University of Maine Law School. It starts at 6:30. The doors are open at 6. There's a half-hour orientation to the plan, and then there's be up to 2.5 hours. It's opportunity to take public comment. And depending on how many people are there, we would be limiting the time for speakers to 3 minutes. If there's not a lot of people, we can certainly, you know, avoid that restriction.
Okay. Anyone else on the council? That's it. Jimmy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was a great presentation. There's a lot of real good questions asked by the council members associated with this. I'm hoping to ask two questions and then use this opportunity to inform everyone around the table of an issue similar. But before we get to that, I think every commercial fisherman or recreational fisherman figures every fish in the ocean is his today before you go fishing. But I didn't know you have reached the low of or the new strategy of adopt a whale for a day process. I mean, this is incredible. Get away from that whale is mine. That's new. I really give you credit for that one. But the question that I would have, sir, and first of all, could you give us the location of that public hearing again tonight? You said it was at 6:30. You named where, but where
just,
is it?
Just a second. Ben, do you have what's the specific address and room number? And
well, make it available so people, anybody that's at the table would like to go.
Okay.
The other question I have is, the only sanctuary that I'm at all familiar with is the Monitor Sanctuary off of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And the urgency for that, creating that sanctuary is because of the deterioration of the monitor, which has since been raised. Big portions, the movable portions that have been raised. The turret, I believe, is in Newport News, mm-hmm. at the Mariners Museum. But in your opinion, is there any difference, after all the smoke clears, in a sanctuary and a monument, other than a circumventing the normal public process? Is there any difference?
Well, under the yes, there is, and a monument is created under the Antiquities Act. And a sanctuary is created under the Sanctuaries Act. Under the Antiquities Act, the management of the monument is shared with the Department of Interior. Okay. Under the Sanctuary Act, the sanctuary is managed by NOAA, so not with another agency. So there are some rather substantial differences.
Okay. Well, that helps a little bit. But for those that are unaware of it, the current administration has got a big one coming. You know, we're talking 5 or 6. I hope everybody's aware of it. One of them is 600,000 square miles. That is a potential closure in the Pacific, but there's some as close as the Mid-Atlantic. So I urge you to at least get informed on this. There ain't a damn thing you can do to stop it, but, you know, just a heads up. We saw what happened with the two species that were eliminated from catch by commercial in the EEZ, so I wouldn't say we've got a favorable chance here. But be ready for this, because this, if it falls through, it's going to make the Hawaiian monument look like a pea compared to what's going to shake down. So please be aware of it so that everybody's not surprised by it. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else on the council? Ed, are you going to the hearing tonight, Ed?
Yes, I am, but I think it's first in
All right, I'll take a few comments from the public, but remember there's a hearing tonight. I'm going to cut it off quickly if you ramble on. Ed? Not you, Ed. That was a general comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. You want me to remain here?
Sure. I'm not going to strangle
you. No, not at this point. In case you want questions answered.
All right, I guess to keep my comments to the council, as has been stated, the council is the group, is the branch of government that in the designation document is directed to make decisions within the sanctuary, fishery regulations decisions. And as such, I believe that best available science should be used in making those decisions. And as everyone here on the council who has sat through the yesterday, unfortunately I wasn't here, but I can just imagine, we all know the difference between 1998, 2001, and 2008. And what the draft management plan does in a lot of places are make conclusions based on VTR data from 2001, a year that we had a intervention plan. We had 7 months of rolling closures. We had 200-pound catch limits. No mention of Framework 42, no mention of differential counting, no mention of the possibility of sectors and what they might do for discards. So I think as we go forward and as the council is asked to go forward, I think that the council should really look deeply at how these conclusions raised in the draft management plan have come about. And are they best available science? Thank you, John.
Thanks, Ed. Vito J.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak. I am not going to the meeting. I've been here for 4 days, unlike some that have been here for 3 days. And I've waited to this moment to speak on this particular one. Mr. Chairman, my name is Vito J. Calamel. I am a past fisherman captain from Gloucester, Massachusetts. I also am the past executive director of the Gloucester Fisheries Commission, and it was the Gloucester Fisheries Commission, a legislatively approved commission, that supported the making of a sanctuary, and it was to protect from mining, graveling, and oil exploration. We went to Representative Studs at the time and Senator John Kerry to bring this forward, guaranteeing our rights to fish forever, whether it be with a jig, a net, a gill net, a drag, or any other such means. This is what we did. This goes back. It's in the archives. I was asked to speak at a World Oceans Plan in Georgetown University about 8 years ago or so. I'm not sure at the time, Mr. Chairman. Don't hold me to that. Where the other director, Brad Barr, at the time, was in charge of the sanctuary. And people from all over the world were there. I don't know why they chose me. I couldn't figure that out, but I was. I took my wife, who's behind me, Mr. Chairman, and this is pertinent information. At that time, I believe Mr. Barr did not know that I was in the audience at the time to listen to his presentation, but he then spoke that he had the power at that time and was going to stop the commercial fishing industry on the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary, where you could understand I was a little lighter at the time and shot out of my seat and probably embarrassed myself and my wife at the time, but I called the gentleman a liar. And I expressed so by doing just what I've told you, that we were guaranteed our rights to fish. It was the Gloucester Fisheries Commission that went to Washington. It was the Gloucester Fisheries Commission, made up of fishermen and fishermen's wives, and State Representative Anthony Verga, who was our executive director, that I took his job after when he left to go to the state legislature. Mr. Chairman, I looked at this report, and I feel that there's a lot of misguided information or wrong information that's been said here. I think Dr. Pierce, being very gentle as he is and not so much myself, kind of hit upon it. I think the slant is wrong. I think the message you're sending is wrong. It isn't what we brought it to be a sanctuary for. It isn't what we supported. We supported it against mining, graveling, and drilling for oil and ruining our fishing grounds. For 400 years, I guess you pointed out Miles Standish showing the cod heads underneath the boat. Well, for 400 years, it's still a very viable fishing area. And as a state chairman of the Massachusetts Fisheries Commission, I voted to shut down fishing activity at one time and still do during the spawning time of these large codfish that appeared 4 to 5 years ago, the biggest I've seen in years, weighing some of them on the scale 40 to 50 pounds. They look like little Vitos at the time. So, Mr. Chairman, I do ask that you listen to people like me. There aren't many of us left. And I was surprised, although I know that this is a great commercial fisheries news newspaper, but on 6A of the commercial fisheries news, and on, I believe it's 7A, there's quite a great article, Stellwagen Fishing Under Attack Once Again. I know that you wanted me to curtail this, and I am going to. I just will say to you in public, in front of this gentleman, who is a gentleman, that the first meeting he held in Gloucester when he received his promotion to this position, he shut me down. And you could say, well, Vito, no one's ever shut you down. Yes, you kid. When you're in my city hall of Gloucester and I was working for the city, I thought it best to allow him to shut me down. He did not allow me to speak on the subject matter. And again, at our Heritage Center, Marine Heritage Center, when I wore dungarees and a sweatshirt at one time, and he was addressing a group down there and says, we will get them fishermen and stop them from fishing. And I looked at him and I took off my cap and I says, I think you're going the wrong direction, sir. And he turned a little white. I guess maybe it was my size. I don't know, but he did turn a little white. But that was how this all got started, and it was guaranteed. Again, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to leave you now because I appreciate it. I'm dead tired, to be honest with you. I was guaranteed our rights to fish forever. And again, I don't care if you fish with a hook. I don't care how you fish. We were guaranteed our rights. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Vito. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Kalin from Winterport, Maine. I'll be very brief. I have spent, though, several hours between, well, over the last 24 hours reading this document thoroughly, and I've got about 15 pages of comments here. I hope I can say them in 3 minutes later tonight, but I want to tell you that the version of this presentation that you got is a sanitized version in terms of its impact on commercial fishing, particularly herring fishing in the Gulf of Maine, and in the Stellwagen Bank area, and the conclusions that are drawn in the document, I think, are scientifically invalid and contrary to what we heard Dr. Overholt speak about the other day. And I'd like to just ask the council to consider, of course, there can't be any fishing regulation by this entity until the designation document is redrafted, as I understand the law. But I'd like to ask the council to pull out the fishing anti-fishing references and descriptions of how particular fisheries would be closed within the area, and ask the Northeast Fisheries Science Center to peer review those statements and conclusions, because I think they're inaccurate. And that's all I'll say today. And when I draft this up before August 4th, I'll certainly send a copy to you. It's an extremely disappointing document. And unfortunately, we're going to have 3 minutes to comment on a 320-page document, because there are references of the herring fishery from the executive summary all the way through to page 320. And it needs to be reviewed by the Science Center. Thank you.
John Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief as well. John Williamson, Ocean Conservancy. I had the privilege, as some people know, I had the privilege to work on the Sanctuaries Advisory Council during the entire management plan review. Chaired the Advisory Council for 4 years, chaired the working group on ecosystem-based management principles that Dave Pierce and Paul Howard were both, and Ed Barrett were all members of. And a consistent theme was heard through in that working group is the Sanctuary Advisory Council developed recommendations that were finally submitted to the sanctuary system. And that was is that just as we saw today with the presentation on harbor porpoise, that there is a law, the MMPA, that is that has its own goals and objectives that are different from fisheries management. There's a law, National Marine Sanctuaries Act, that is at work that has its own set of goals and objectives that are different from fisheries management. And what we heard in the Sanctuary Advisory Council and the working group is that those people who were concerned with fisheries and fisheries management wanted to see consultation and coordinated planning with this body and the sanctuary system. In the end, the sanctuary system is part of NOAA, and regulations can be developed for the National Marine Sanctuaries Act within NOAA. But this body has a particular responsibility for fisheries in New England, and it would be the creation of better policy over the long run for regulations that are going to affect fisheries to be done consistent the way this body is, the strategies that this body is pursuing for the range of fisheries under your jurisdiction. So I think that is the message that was given consistently into the Sanctuary Advisory Council. It has been taken seriously by the sanctuary system here in the region. It's also part of this document. I think that's why Craig's here today. Thanks, Craig. That was a good presentation.
Harriet? No, not yet. We're still on the Stellwagen Bank. Chris?
Hi, Chris Wiener, East Coast Tuna Association. Rich Roué asked me to come today. He's our executive director. I just have a couple questions for you, Craig. Does the sanctuary staff think they can establish marine preserves or other restrictions directly impact fishing activities without seeking an act of Congress changing the original Stellwagen Bank designation document? And do you want me to just read them out? If so, how is it consistent with the February 20, 2004 memorandum to you from Michael Weiss, Deputy Director, National Marine Sanctuary Program? Where under point two, Weiss declares in response to the question, can the SBNMS currently regulate fishing activities with the following answer? No, fishing is not an activity listed as a subject to regulation in the SBNMS designation document. Therefore, it cannot be regulated without amending the designation document. Third question, has the sanctuary staff or anyone else, has the designation document been so amended to allow that for fishing to be affected? And fourth, if the SBNMS staff and other groups seek to amend the designation document, this will be the third major fight over the issue of whether the SBNMS has such authority. Is the limited research information likely to result from a marine preserve worth the risk of losing the remaining values of public education and preventing other adverse activities, i.e. the 10 authorized protections under the designation document on the bank resulting from the sanctuary? So,
if you feel like you can answer any of those, go ahead.
Well, just I think in general, and it probably relates to a lot of the other questions that have been just raised, is that the sanctuary is required under the law to work through a very prescribed process of working with the regional fishery agencies and regional councils in each of the regions where they work. We have every intention of abiding by the law and working through the due process. What that means is we're seeking complementary conservation, across the regional agencies, fisheries and sanctuary, and we're looking for collaboration. We have no intention of trying to do something on our own. The it's the plan, I thought, was quite explicit in saying that. We even include in the appendix what the process is. I don't know what else to say.
I would just add, you know, from my own perspective, I've been fishing my whole life, and I've never seen anyone intentionally or even unintentionally hook a whale. So, I mean, that one picture just, you know, I'd just be careful throwing that around because it's painting a picture that's not true. Thank you.
Paul Howard.
Just one question. The first question he had, I'm under the impression that the regulations have to come from the council, that under the Sanctuaries Act, you can't establish anything that impacts fishing unless the document is changed, the designation document. That clearly is in place now. In the executive summary, you reference that, Craig, and say that that would have to be changed. And that's the impression I've always been under, that if you want to set up a no fishing zone, I think the designation document would have to be changed, and that's a matter of a congressional action. That's the impression I was under.
That's correct,
right.
Paul.
If
we thought there was a need for like a no-take marine reserve, right. Okay, we'd have to come to the council and ask, here's what we're trying to do. We'd like you folks to, you know, to do that. Just a second. This is Ed Lindelof from the National Marine Sanctuary Program. Could he just offer a comment as well?
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm Ed Lindelof from the Sanctuaries Program, senior policy advisor. I've been with the program for about 25 years. I know some of you folks, some I don't, been involved in Stellwagen on and off, and have been involved in a number of these designation document kind of issues, which get very complicated and very touchy very quickly. The sanctuary would not require, it requires us to change the designation document to issue any regulation that's outside the scope of the designation document. It does not require a congressional action, however. That is something we do administratively through essentially the Administrative Procedures Act. We would have to do, the sanctuary statute requires us that if we go to change a designation document, we have to go through the same process, administrative process, that was originally used to designate the sanctuary. In a nutshell, in order to change the designation document, we have to do an EIS, and we have to propose it through rulemaking, just as you know, you all, NIMS proposes rulemaking. So it's really a more extensive rulemaking process, but it does not require congressional action at all.
And it does not require Congress to agree?
No. It gives Congress the opportunity to object, which is a slight difference. The process to designate a sanctuary requires an EIS, and it requires us to go to Congress. And Congress has an opportunity, it's a 45-day period, whereby they can make objections to the designation or change the designation. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further from the council? Craig, thank you.
Thanks, all of you. I appreciated your time, and I appreciate your questions. And we would welcome, if you wanted to follow that up with written comments, we would wish you would. Okay, thank you very much.
I think for the benefit of the council members, we're going to ask, I think maybe Chad or Paul will decide, to listen to the audio of this discussion and to fashion a letter from the council touching on the issues that have been brought up by the council members. Okay. Thank you. We're going to move into research steering. Dave, do you need about 5 minutes to get everything